You're listening to The Point. Now we hear the stories of two different people suffering from post-traumatic stress. Here's WCAI's Catherine Iden.
We often associate post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, with veterans returning home from war. But PTSD does not stop there. Anyone who has a traumatic experience, from sexual and domestic abuse to car accidents, can be affected by the disorder. Red Sox Senior Director for Grounds David Meller knows this all too well. He survived not one, but two accidents where he was hit by a car. Dozens of surgeries and years of therapy later, he's written a memoir detailing his struggle to identify and overcome PTSD. And he's managed to do all this while rising to the top of his field, becoming a leading innovator in sports turf management and working in what he calls his dream job for his favorite team. David joins us this morning. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
David, baseball and PTSD are very closely intertwined for you. Your memoir opens with you writing about how baseball, and particularly the Red Sox, is practically part of your family's DNA. And of course, you work for the Red Sox now, a dream you've had since you were a child. Tell us a little bit about your passion for the Red Sox.
Yes, ma'am. My grandfather played in 1902 in the majors, and my dream was to follow in his footsteps. I played baseball growing up, had baseball opportunities to play in college, and a month after I got out of high school, I was walking into a McDonald's restaurant, and a car came off the street and hit me, threw me 20 feet in the air, and I slammed into the brick wall right at the entrance of the door of McDonald's, and the car came at a higher rate of speed and hit me a second time, pinning my knee against the wall. And at the time, I thought not only was my leg crushed, I thought my dreams were crushed. I thought, what am I going to do now if I can't play baseball? And my family told me actually how lucky I was, and to find a career that I would love to do, because so many people don't love their job, and that to really find a passion during those times. Because, you know, I walked on crutches for 2.5 years. I walked with a cane for 10 months, had to learn how to walk again. And there were a lot of tough times, and they told me to really use that time wisely. And so I thought, what do I love to do? I loved baseball. I grew up taking care of people's lawns. I loved science. I love being outside, and I thought someone has to be a major league groundskeeper. And I grew up a Red Sox fanatic. My dream was to someday stand on Fenway Park's mound as a pitcher. And now I could stand on Fenway's mound every day. And, you know, I'm very humbled and honored to have that opportunity. My job is the next best thing to playing.
And interestingly, when you came to the idea that you should be a groundskeeper and you went to Ohio State, you were kind of at the leading edge, at least for groundskeepers other than those at golf courses and things like that. Is that right?
Well, you know, when I went to Ohio State, I was the first student there to study sports turf management. Everyone had gone there for lawn care or golf courses. And while there were incredible groundskeepers in the industry at that time, they'd kind of gone through the school of hard knocks. There was one groundskeeper, Roger Bossard, for the White Sox, who had a sports turf degree from Purdue. But other than that, you know, it was kind of learning through the through challenges, and they were just amazing groundskeepers. But the industry was kind of becoming much using education combined with experience. And so I was very fortunate to come in at the right time for that opportunity.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, you're considered an innovator. You were one of the first to use patterns in the field, which are now pretty commonplace and pretty spectacular, really interesting and intricate designs in the grass. How did you come to that? What inspired that, and how do you make those designs?
Well, you know, my brother raised me. My dad died when I was 3, and my mom and 2 brothers helped raise me, and one of my brothers taught me to take a lot of pride in when I took care of lawns growing up, how I made money, and told me to take pride in mowing straight lines. And then I worked at a golf course where Jack Nicklaus grew up when I was in college, and I quickly realized the better I mowed, the nicer holes and areas around the course I got to mow. And when I got a job with the Brewers, same thing, the better I mowed, the more opportunities I had. And I quickly realized you could also, you know, whether it was a traditional checkerboard pattern or something unique, you have one opportunity to make a first impression with anything in life. So whether you're your home lawn, a corporate green space, or an athletic field, you have that one opportunity to capture someone's attention. So any mower will make a pattern in the grass with its tires and its blade and its deck. But our mowers also have a roller on them, So that roller helps bend the grass blade. So you think of like vacuuming the carpet, it changes the nap of the carpet. The grass blade actually gets bent. So a light stripe goes away from you and a dark stripe comes towards you. So patterns are really only limited by your imagination. However, growing up a Red Sox fanatic and being an Ohio State Buckeye grad, I think there are two patterns I'd recommend you don't do. That would be a Yankee logo and a Michigan logo, because I think that'd probably kill the grass. But otherwise, I encourage you to have fun. And, you know, from our end, safety and playability is always the first priority. So we achieve that. But I'm fortunate to have incredible coworkers, and they take a lot of pride in their work.
Yeah, and there are just so many amazing designs. I was looking at one of Big Poppy, and of course, there's been so many others, American flags and things like that. You work at one of the oldest parks as we know. It's a living piece of history, Fenway Park. But when you started, when you started at Fenway, you had just been at one of the country's newest parks, and after a rainstorm, you saw fish on the field. This is a quirky thing about Fenway, learning an older park. Can you tell us that story? You thought somebody was playing a joke on you, but you learned that, in fact, it's just it's just Fenway.
Yes, ma'am. So I had the honor to follow in Mr. Joe Mooney's footsteps, who is a legendary groundskeeper, had been with the Red Sox for 30 years. And so when I sat down with Mr. Mooney my first day at Fenway, we were talking about how ballparks were similar and different. And at that time, Fenway had last time there was a major renovation was 1934, and I started, my first season was in 2001. And so in January, Mr. Mooney and I sat down, and he said, David, if it really rains hard, the dugouts flood. And back then there was a big crown to the field, so the water would shed off to the sides. And I had seen the dugouts flood in Milwaukee and a few other parks, so I said, okay, Mr. Mooney. And he said, David, if it really, really rains hard, the storm drain system on the city street can't handle that microburst of a storm, and the water will back up through the city drain pipe and come up through the manhole covers in the concourse, and the concourse behind third base will flood. And I thought, that's pretty heavy. And he said, David, if it really, really, really rains hard, water from the city streets will back up, and the first base camera pit will fill all the way to the top with water, and fish from the Charles River will swim through the city drain pipes and swim out on the field. Well, out of respect to Mr. Mooney, I said, wow, Mr. Mooney, that's incredible. And just thought he was telling me a story. In fact, I went home and told my wife, you won't believe the jokes that Mr. Mooney tells. Well, fast forward, that year we opened on a Monday in April. And on Friday night before that opening day, we were supposed to get 2 to 3 inches of rain. So we put the tarp on. And sure enough, the next morning, it stopped raining close to 6-7 o'clock. And we had close to 3 inches of rain. So I walked out on the warning track behind home plate, got near the first base dugout, and I looked, and there was a fish about 6 inches long on the edge of the grass. I thought, oh my gosh, Mr. Mooney set me up for a joke 3 months ago. I look up in the stands thinking he was hiding somewhere, and he was nowhere to be found. I yelled his name. I walk over to the camera pit, and sure enough, it's full to the top with water. And between the camera pit and where the second baseman plays, there were 7 more fish on top of the tarp. I couldn't believe it. Luckily, I had a camera in my desk, and we took a picture of the fish, but the sun came out, and tarps on top of grass with sun aren't good, so we took the tarp off, and the rush of getting ready for opening day, we threw the fish away, but at least I have a copy of the photo still. But I wish I would have dry-mounted a fish for my office, for his, for owners, but it's definitely a true fish story. But what's funny is current ownership has invested over $300 million, making incredible improvements in Fenway. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they did is they put in a new first base camera pit. And when they excavated the old camera pit, there was a drain line in there that was supposed to have a valve gate in it that when it rained hard, it would open and let the water out of the camera pit and close behind it. But it had been halfway open with sediment, so it couldn't close. So anytime that heavy rain would come in from the city, that water could always come in and fish, or fish would come in with the water. And I shared this story with the tour guides one off season when I was doing a PowerPoint presentation with them. And they said they had seen pictures somewhere from the 60s of players using little kids' fishing poles and popcorn catching fish in that camera pit before.
Oh my gosh. So I love that story.
That, Yeah, I haven't seen that picture yet. So if someone has that picture, I'd love to see it.
Any fish since the new turf has been put down, and you've made so many changes to the park and upgrades now with the field?
No fish since then, no ma'am.
Well, your journey, of course, David, has had so many career highlights and achievements. But as you write in your latest book, in your memoir, a lot of struggle. And you mentioned that when you were just out of high school, you had an accident where you were hit by a car. And since then, a lot of your journey has also been about pain, right? I mean, you had physical pain, of course, from the injury from your knee, but you also began right away to feel some emotional and psychological pain. Can you talk about what happened in that immediate aftermath and what you felt?
Yes, ma'am. You know, we all deal with struggles in our lives, whether it's physical or emotional pain. And, you know, I starting that first night after I was hit by the car, I started having nightmares. In fact, I had 1 to 5 very vivid, lifelike vivid nightmares, 1 to 5 nightmares every night for 29 years. Mm. I mean, I was scared to go to sleep at night. I knew as well as the sun going down at night, I was going to have a nightmare that night. I was scared to go to sleep at night. I slept with the TV on so that my roommates, initially when I was in college, when I would wake up screaming at night, if they said something, I could tell my roommates, oh, that was just a TV. To when I got married, I would scream at night. My wife would wake up. I'd say, oh, it's just a TV. Mm. To later when I would scream, my daughters would say, hey, what was that? I could hope I could tell people it's the TV. And during the day, I was having flashbacks. If I smelled car exhaust, if I heard squealing tires, revving engines, flashbacks would even be triggered if I smelled McDonald's French fries. Mm. And I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't have any idea why this was happening. I just thought it was a burden I needed to carry. I tried to make the best of it. It seemed that the busier I kept myself, whether with school studies, work, my triggers during the day weren't as active, but every night I knew these nightmares were coming, and I was scared to go to sleep. In fact, there was a time when I tried drinking at night, thinking that at the time it would help me sleep. And, you know, now after going through counseling, I realized that's a form of self-medication. And in 2006, my wife came down to see me in the basement. I'd have dinner with my family. Then I'd go down to the basement, drink some beers, hoping that, you know, I wasn't getting drunk, but it would just hopefully numb my pain and help me sleep better. And she said, you know, David, I wish you would not come down and you're separating yourself from me and the girls, and we wish you wouldn't do that. And it was like a lightning bolt to my heart. I never dawned on me that was happening. The last thing I thought I was going down there to, if I slept better, I had this vicious circle of reasoning that if I slept better, hopefully I'd be a better dad, I'd be a better husband. And it was just the opposite of what I was doing. And so I stopped drinking that day and hadn't had a drink since. But my, you know, nightmares and flashbacks continued. Luckily that fall, I did start with pain management, went to Mass General and started on pain management, working with my doctors. But it wasn't until September 2010 when another lucky day in my life, I happened to pick up a Smithsonian magazine during acupuncture. And there was 50 magazines there, and I could have picked up any one of them. And I just happened to open this Smithsonian magazine to this page where there's an article in there about a new treatment facility for veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress. And I thought I would read it because my daughter was interning at that time at the Home Base Program, which is an incredible treatment facility for veterans and active duty and their families at Mass General, dealing with PTSD and TBI. So I thought I'd read it to learn about what my daughter was doing. And the first paragraph listed 10 symptoms or 12 symptoms of PTSD. And as I read them, chills just ran through my body. Hair stood up my arms, my neck, and tears started rolling down my face because I realized I either actively had or had dealt with 10 of those 12 symptoms. The only ones I did not have were suicide or drug use. And while it scared me, it gave me hope. It gave me hope that I mean, up until that time, it never dawned on me I could have PTSD. I thought PTSD was only something someone from the military could have. And it scared me that I could have it, but it gave me hope that if this is what I had, that hopefully I could get treatment. And by getting treatment, I could be a better dad and I could be a better husband. And so I went home right away and told my wife, honey, we've got to talk. And I opened my soul up and shared with her all these raw, buried emotions that I had kept inside since July 10th, 1981. And my wife and I met in October of 82. And I used to drive in the car back and forth to work, to college, rehearsing out loud in the car, how could I describe these symptoms I'm going through? How could I describe them to her? She's absolutely my best friend. I never want to lie to her. But I was living basically a second life with all these raw buried emotions inside of me because I was scared if I didn't explain them right that she wouldn't understand and she would leave me. I didn't give her the credit that she deserved. But when I went home and told her, honey, we've got to talk, all those fears, things I thought she might say, she didn't say. She said, honey, we'll get through this together. Let's call your doctor and let's go to Mass General tomorrow. And I just can't thank her enough for that incredible support. We went to Mass General the next day and I walked in with my head down, my hat pulled down, hoping no one would recognize me. I was nervous going there. I was excited in some ways. I was ashamed in other ways. And now when I walk in to see my psychologist, I'm proud to be a PTSD survivor. I want people to learn from my challenges, my mistakes, and know that, you know, we want to inspire people with hope, to let them know that they're not alone, that help's available and treatment works. We all go through challenges and struggles. You know, when I was going through that, I didn't realize that. But now when I look up in the stands at Fenway, I realize everybody there, either themselves or their loved ones, going through something. I mean, we're all human. We all face challenges. And, you know, I tell you, counseling has improved my life and my family's life in incredible ways. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it and say it's easy, but it's definitely an investment in yourself and your family. It's well worth doing.
Well, one thing I think is remarkable in reading your book, David, is that you had this initial horrific accident that triggered PTSD with you, and you tried to find hope. You had faith in God. You had a strong family network that helped inspire you to become a groundskeeper. And you even talk about trying to physically cope in your rehab by taking your kind of competitive gamesmanship mentality and forming your philosophy that's now the book title, One Base at a Time. But that also, deeper down, these emotional things, as you say, that you just couldn't even begin to articulate, you had to carry them with you. And then incredibly, you had other injuries. You had another accident where you were hit by another car on the job, and you've had other injuries that kind of compounded your PTSD. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. I've been hit by a car 3 times. I figure that's better than 4. I've had 46 or 45 surgeries to date, and I figure that's better than 46. You know, in 1995, in October, we were resodding the field at County Stadium when I was working for the Brewers. And beautiful fall day, not a cloud in the sky, basically. And all the sod was off the field, and I was out in left field raking around an irrigation head. And we had a big field gate. Entrance gate behind the left fielder. And I thought I heard a car, and I thought, that's odd. And so I looked, and there was a car coming from behind the bleachers toward the field. And there was not supposed to be any cars there that day. And I ran over to where the warning track met the open gate and put my arms up. And this lady smiled as big as she could and stepped on the gas and came right at me. And I had my arms raised. I raised my left leg, and she hit me. And I hit the windshield and bounced off and landed in a pile at the base of the outfield wall pads. She went speeding down the warning track toward home plate, kind of fishtailed behind the home plate, throwing track material, I was told, 10 rows up in the stands, made a full lap around the track. And as she was getting closer toward me, she veered her car from the edge of the grass curve toward right, you know, to aim right at me. I thought, oh my gosh, she's going to run me right over. And at the last minute, she swerved to miss me and slammed on the brakes. When the car stops beside me, she sits up so she can see me and smiles and waves at me. And then she steps on the gas and peels out and covers me in track material and goes through the gate. And, you know, my life had just flashed before my eyes, and I was, you know, adrenaline flushed through me, and I pulled myself up against the wall pads and limped out behind the bleachers, and I could hear her screaming on my way there, and I get behind the bleachers, and she's out of her car dressed in a trench coat and a business suit, and she's screaming every cuss word I've ever heard at the guard to let her out. And the wooden security guard gate arm is splintered on the ground, and she's screaming at the guard, and I see off to the side her car is still running and the door's open, so I thought I better take the keys out or she's going to run someone else over or go drive on the field. And so as soon as I turn the car off, she comes running over and gets right in my face and spitting and screaming cuss words at me to give her her keys. And I said, I'm sorry, ma'am, I can't do that. So she, you know, kind of pushes me and gets in the car and slams the door. And about that time, the deputies show up, and I knew the deputies from the ballpark. They ask what happened, and I told them briefly, and they asked her to get out of the car, and she wouldn't do it. So I gave them the keys, and they unlocked the door, and she grabbed an ink pen and tried to stab the deputies. So they got her out of the car and put handcuffs on her and put her in the back of a squad car. Beautiful day. They put the window partway down, and they said, David, do you mind filling out this police report on the back of this other squad car before you go to the hospital? And so while they're talking to this lady, they said, you know, why are you here? And she said, well, I'm here to do a stunt for the movie, and if it doesn't work, I'm supposed to kill myself. And so they said, this is on a Thursday, they said, well, they would take her to the county mental hospital to see if they could help her. And so on Sunday night, I get a phone call from an attorney that said, you know, we'd like you to come testify tomorrow at the courtroom at the hospital, otherwise she's going to be let go. And I said, well, I'd rather not be the only person there if, you know, she's this troubled. And they said, no, there'll be other people there. So we went that day, and she was in her room in a straitjacket and waived her right to appear in person. So the police officer testified, and then I testified, and then a doctor got up and testified and said she has a past history with mental illness. In 1991, she was arrested in Florida for stalking Julio Iglesias. Mm. 1993, she was arrested on international charges, threatening the Queen of England. And the night before she did this at County Stadium, she tried to assault Oprah in Chicago, but she got away, but they got pictures of her. And so the judge said, well, we can have another hearing on Wednesday. And so I went back on Wednesday, and this time she was there, and she was on her fifth attorney. And so she just stared at me most of the hearing, just giving me kind of the evil eye. And police officer testified, I testified, doctor testified, and judge said, well, we can keep her for 6 months or until we find a medicine that works. And he put the gavel down, and she jumped up and started cussing at the judge, telling him, don't tell me what to do, I know what to do. And her attorney said, you know, settle down, this isn't the way to act. And she put her finger in his face, and you said, you shut the bleep up, you work for me. And she lunged across the aisle, shaking her hand violently at me, saying, I want to know, did I come within 1 foot, 2 foot, or 3 foot of hitting you? Because I always miss at 1 foot. And the judge said, clear the courtroom and subdue her. And so as I was leaving, they were subduing her. And so, you know, that could have certainly been much worse. I was fortunate things weren't worse that day.
Mm. Having to recount these stories, is it hard? That's a harrowing experience. And did it also make your PTSD worse? I mean, you didn't know at the time that that's what, in part, you were suffering from. But I can't imagine having to go through it and then having to recount that.
Oh, yes, ma'am. It certainly intensified my nightmares. You know, I would see her laughing in my nightmares. It certainly intensified my nightmares and my flashbacks. And that was another part of, you know, my exposure therapy with counseling, breaking those down. And, part of my therapy was to work through each of my raw, buried emotions one by one. I went for counseling for an hour on Mondays, an hour and a half on Fridays, and we worked through these one by one, and I would write them out initially on paper, and then my wife would transcribe them on the computer, and then I would write them to myself, I would read them to myself, I would then read them out loud, then I would read them out loud to my counselor, and with my permission, she would record them, give me the only copy, and then in between appointments, I would listen to them while I continued to write. And that would help desensitize each one of these raw emotions. And while it was extremely difficult, it started to help. Mm. And then February 23rd, 2011, I slept through the night for the first time in 29 years. And it was amazing when I woke up. I couldn't believe it. You know, I wanted to jump up and down and scream to the world and wake my wife and tell my doctors, but I'm so superstitious, I didn't tell anybody. And the next 3 days in a row, I slept without a nightmare. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And, you know, none of that would have been possible without counseling. Mm. And what's amazing is, you know, I've only had two nightmares since. I had two nightmares in November of 2015. And, fortunately, I have an amazing service dog, Drago, who we talk about in the book, and we want to bring awareness to how amazing service dogs are, and we talk about that in the book. And Drago was there for those nightmares, and he woke me up. And like I say, we want to bring awareness to how amazing service dogs are. And mm-hmm. Counseling has changed my life for the better in so many ways and helped my family. And, you know, if I would have given up at any point during my challenges or given up during the challenging times of counseling, none of this would have been possible. So I can't stress to people enough to hang in there during their challenges. And when they start counseling, if they don't fit with their counselor or with the type of counseling they're trying, you know, don't just say one and done, that I'm not gonna do it again. Find a different counselor or find a different course of treatment, whether it's somatic experience or a different type of therapy, because it's well worth the investment in yourself and in your family.
Mm. And you write that your PTSD, you say it's in remission in a way, that it's a journey and that you still have it, but that you've learned to kind of work through some of these experiences. And you acknowledge that life happens and tough experiences can happen to you as well.
Yes, ma'am. You know, life goes on. And, you know, new traumas are going to happen in your life. Old triggers are going to come up. And, you know, I continue to see my counselor, and I'm proud of that. I encourage people to never think that you go once and you don't go back. You know, it's important to continue to work through those, whether it's anniversaries that are triggers in your life, whether it's a new trauma, an old trauma. I talk about in the book where, you know, things seem like we're going great, and I had some traumas come up in my life over the last couple of years, you know, just last year, and we're working through those. And that's something that I just can't stress to people enough, is to celebrate life every day. Make the most of every opportunity you have. Tell the people around you how important they are, and just really be thankful what you can do. Focus on what you can do and not what you can't. You know, it's important just to really look at every day as a blessing and just have fun with your life.
We've talked about you've had these two accidents, you've had dozens of surgeries. Do you have you thought about why perhaps with all those medical professionals that you saw over the years that somebody didn't think to maybe take a look at you and talk with you about the fact that you might have PTSD? I mean, it took you finding this article to really have the light go off, and then you sought help. You had the strength within you to seek help. But have you ever thought about why it took so long?
You know, I've wondered sometimes, you know, no one ever mentioned it to my mother. No one, you know, back then, PTSD wasn't really talked about. But then certainly since then, no one even pulled my wife to the side and said, hey, what do you think about this? And it just never dawned on me. Literally, it just never dawned on me I could have PTSD. I just thought it was a burden that I had to carry. I didn't know I could get help. I didn't think someone could relate to what I was going through. And I want people to learn from my mistakes so they don't suffer in silence like I did, that there is help available. There really is. And it's just amazing how the counselors could relate to me and help me. And I didn't think that was possible going into it. And I never thought that for 29 years. Never dawned on me. Like I say, I thought it was a sign of weakness to ask for help. And now I know it's a sign of strength and takes courage to ask for help. And we want to help break that stigma because it's nothing to be ashamed of. It's something to be proud of. And like I say, I hope when somebody sees me sitting in a psychologist's office, they don't hesitate to, you know, ask me why I'm there, because I'm proud to be there. It's changed my world.
David Meller is Senior Director for Grounds for the Boston Red Sox. In his latest book, One Base at a Time, How I Survived PTSD and Found the Field of My Dreams, is out June 11th. David, thank you so much for sharing your story both in the book and this morning here with us.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.